From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Go back 100,000 years. It's not that long ago when you consider the age of the planet. Chris Stringer of the Natural History Museum in London says we think there were about six different kinds of humans on the Earth at the time. There were Neanderthals, Homo erectus, Java man, and Homo sapiens, of course. And all of them, except us, have disappeared. And why? Why did we survive? Were we better at hunting? Did we develop better tools? Was it our language that set us apart, our art? Or did we just happen to get lucky? Maybe the weather was just better. Stringer says we're getting closer to understanding the journey of human evolution, and he's joining us today to explain what we know about ourselves. After the news.
Hey, I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West, inviting you to check out Video West. It's our online showcase of short documentaries about the places and people that make Utah what it is. You can stream the films at videowest.kuer.org, and if you like what you see and hear, we hope you'll share it with your friends. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The recent discovery of what is being called a new human species in a cave system in South Africa got us thinking about the origins of humankind. And these are pretty big questions. Where do modern humans come from exactly? And what does that mean exactly to be a modern human? That is, what sets us apart, the Homo sapiens, from other versions of early humans? Is it language? Is it culture? And when did we become this version of human beings that we are today? Why did we succeed when others failed? Renowned paleoanthropologist Chris Stringer has spent his life trying to figure all of this out. In 2012, he wrote an influential book called Lone Survivors, where he explained, as the subtitle goes, how we came to be the only humans on Earth. And he said that when he was writing that book, he had to keep going back and rewriting things as new developments and new discoveries kept coming. Now, 3 years on, imagine how the story might have changed. Chris Stringer is joining us today to talk about all of this. We invite you to join us if you have your own comments and questions. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Chris Stringer is a researcher at the Natural History Museum in London and a fellow of the Royal Society. He's authored more than 200 books and papers on the subject of human evolution, including the book I mentioned, Lone Survivors, How We Came to Be the Only Humans on Earth. He's joining us today from a studio in London. And Chris Stringer, welcome. Thank you very much for doing this.
Oh, it's a pleasure to speak to you.
I wanted to begin with your own personal connection to this story, because you write a bit about this in Lone Survivors. You say in the book that working at the Natural History Museum there in London and studying the origins of humankind, this was a boyhood dream. Would you say something more about that? You've been thinking about this for a long time.
Well, yes. I mean, I was born in London, and so at weekends, if I was lucky, my parents took me to the Natural History Museum. And obviously, like many kids today, I was fascinated by the dinosaurs, by many of the exhibitions there. But there were human fossils, and those had a particular appeal. And I remember seeing, you know, a skull from what's now Zambia, from a site called Broken Hill, and there was a replica of that skull there. And I was about 5 years old, and I just remember seeing it and being really excited. And I think, you know, my parents let me go and speak to one of the warding staff, and I said, look, if ever you have any of these spare, could you keep one for me? So the guy was very amused, of course. And I collected fossils of ammonites and things like that. So I had a long-term interest in fossils, but I must admit, when I got into my teenage years, I didn't imagine you could even study the subject at university, let alone end up perhaps working in that area. It was a complete chance event, really, that led to me studying anthropology and eventually ending up at the Natural History Museum.
Well, you were going to study medicine, but then at 18, you kind of last minute made a switch.
Well, that's right, yes. I was on track to go to medical school, and I'd been offered a place at London Hospital Medical School. And then, just by chance, one of my friends had been to an interview at University College for a physics degree, and he brought the prospectus of University College back, and he threw it over and said, have a look at this stringer. And it was alphabetic, and it opened on A for anthropology. And I looked at it and said, wow, this is amazing. Here's human evolution and prehistory and so on, and this is fantastic. No one had told me that you could even do this at university. That's how I suppose I had a very sheltered upbringing. And so I thought about switching. My parents were obviously very uncertain. My teachers certainly were very uncertain. They said, you'll never get this. There's no career in that. You know, stick with being a doctor. Mm. But I did switch. I managed to get into an interview at the last minute, and they offered me a place. So yes, that's how I got into anthropology, and obviously I've been very lucky along the way to end up working in one of the major places in the world for the study of human evolution.
When you were a boy then, looking at those skulls on those, you know, weekend expeditions to the History Museum, what were you seeing in those skulls that fascinated you, do you think? Do you think you understand what it was that was so interesting about them?
I think at the earlier stage, not really. But by the time I was 9 or 10, I was actually writing little projects at school on the Neanderthals. I wish I had them. They've long gone, sadly. And I was drawing skulls and putting them together in evolutionary trees. They're all, of course, hopelessly out of date now. But and my parents, of course, thought this was very odd, drawing skulls. Well, it didn't seem a very healthy thing, but they kind of tolerated it. And so I had that interest long term. But as I say, I didn't imagine I could end up ever actually working in that area.
One of the things that you say in your book is that you hope that your work will make readers think about what it means to be human, to change their perceptions about our origins. We'll dig down and deeply into the particulars as we go, but let's talk more broadly about what do you mean by that? That you want readers to be thinking about, to broaden their perceptions of what it means to be human?
Obviously we can look at ourselves today. We can see our closest living relatives, the chimpanzees, and there is evidently a huge gulf between us. But obviously when you look under the surface, when you look at the anatomy of a chimpanzee and the musculature and the way its teeth develop, there are major similarities. And of course, genetically, we have major similarities. So undoubtedly, humans are part of this wider ape group, and particularly related to the African apes. But there is still this big gulf, of course, which represents many millions of years of separate evolution between us and the apes. And when we go back to the time of Charles Darwin, of course, people began to think about human evolution. But it took many more years before any early fossils came from Africa to start to illustrate those earlier stages of human evolution. In fact, it was that Broken Hill skull that I mentioned, seeing a replica of at the museum when I was about 5, that was found in 1921, and that was the first really significant ancient fossil ever to be found in Africa. So it took a long time for the African evidence to start to come through. The Neanderthals, of course, were being found when Darwin was alive, and he was aware of them. But, of course, they represent a much more, we could say, evolved kind of human, something that has a large brain. The very primitive forms, such as this Homo naledi, this new species from South Africa, we've only learnt about those in the last 100 years or so.
So we're going to get to some of the big questions you break down in your book as we go. These are the questions that keep coming up again and again about the origins of the human species. What do you figure, though, first is, what's the biggest? What are the most critical questions, do you think, that we're still trying to figure out right now? The biggest one, the big ones, I guess.
Well, some of the biggest ones, and still the unsolved ones, of course, are concern issues where we really can't get at them directly from the fossil evidence. So, of course, in the fossils, we can look at jaws and teeth and bones, but the brain, of course, is a huge question here. So we've got this large brain, and it's clearly extremely important to humans, and it clearly is something which has grown in size as we look at the path of human evolution. And it does differentiate us, of course, from the other apes, this very large brain. And it's critical to our survival. And one of the issues is, you know, how special is our brain compared with the brain of some of the other human species, that were around in the last 100,000 years? So the Neanderthals had very large brains as well. In fact, their brains are slightly larger on average than the brains of humans today. But what's the quality of that brain? And this is, of course, where, unfortunately, the evidence eludes us, because we haven't got any fossil brains. We can take an impression of the inside of a Neanderthal skull, or we can take a virtual image from a CT scan of a Neanderthal, and we can get the shape of the brain out. We can see it's big, and we can see roughly how it's proportioned. But what was its quality? What was its internal wiring? Did the Neanderthals have language, just as we do, the language we're using now? Could they have been born into a modern human group and learnt to speak and grow up as we do? And these are some of the most fascinating issues about what may or may not make us different. And I happen to believe that the complex language of modern humans came out of social complexity. Mm-hmm. You know, we live in large groups. We have, obviously, spiritual beliefs, so we can talk about virtual worlds, worlds that aren't here, mm-hmm. worlds in our imagination. We can talk about the distant past. We can talk about the future. So that kind of complex language we use all the time is fundamental for us. But I'd love to know how much of that the Neanderthals shared. And I suspect that they certainly had speech. I'm sure they were talking to each other. Mm-hmm. And we can see that even from elements in their skeleton. There's a bone called the hyoid bone that sits in the throat and is connected to the vocal apparatus. And it looks like the hyoid bone of Neanderthals is really essentially the same as ours. So on that basis, it looks like they had the apparatus for speech. Some people have modelled their speech and think they would have, because of the length of their vocal tract, they would have had higher-pitched voices, wow. which perhaps doesn't go with our image of the Neanderthals.
Right.
That they might have had higher-pitched voices than us, but maybe they did. But I think they had speech and were talking to each other, but I doubt that they had that level of complexity we have today. I think that's something which perhaps is special to modern humans. But, of course, it's something which we lack most of the evidence for, and we have to get at it indirectly by looking at what our ancestors and what the Neanderthals did with their brains. What kind of tools did they make? Mm-hmm. How complex was their behaviour? Then we have to use that to judge some of these things which really are interesting about us and them.
This is going to... It seems like, I've been thinking a lot lately about the idea of consciousness. And this is going to sound like a kind of uninformed question, because I'm not really sure how paleoanthropologists talk about or think about the idea of human consciousness, which I loosely define as sort of, that concept of self-awareness and, the capacity to consider our medical, metaphysical condition, worry about our mortality. It's sometimes described as sentience or subjectivity. How much does that idea? And I guess the question is, what do we know about early humans, and at what point did they evolve a sense of what we would now describe as consciousness? Does that make sense?
Mm. Well, it makes sense as a question, but of course it's another one of these very elusive things, perhaps even more elusive than working out whether the Neanderthals could speak to each other. What we can say is that the Neanderthals, for example, buried their dead.
Right.
It's disputed. There are still some archaeologists who doubt that they did, but I think the evidence is pretty strong that the Neanderthals buried their dead. There's evidence that they cared for each other when people were injured, when they were sick. They lived certainly longer than you would expect, with some quite disabling injuries, for example. So there was that level of social care. So I think that, given that they're burying their dead, I think the Neanderthals did have that self-awareness. There is certainly the beginning now of evidence emerging that the Neanderthals produced symbolic artifacts, and this has been a big issue which I discussed quite a bit in the book, that obviously we have art and we have representational art. And I think that, the cave art in France, 35,000 years old, the little statuettes of animals and humans made of ivory that are 35 or 40,000 years old, those I think are so far unique to modern humans. But the Neanderthals were making jewellery, it seems. They were piercing animal teeth and they were wearing them. And they were using pigments, red and black pigments, in large quantities. And this looks like it wasn't a practical thing. They weren't just using it to keep the insects away or to soften animal skins. It looks like they were marking their bodies with these pigments. So I think with that level of identity of a person, I think that, you know, self-awareness almost certainly was there in the Neanderthals. Again, perhaps not in the complexity that we have, because I think the Neanderthals lived in smaller groups, and I think their life was somewhat simpler, shall we say, than that of the modern humans who produced the cave art. But so was
maybe
the behaviour
of
our ancestors. I think that the evidence is that Neanderthals were living in relatively small groups, and the genetic data suggests that they were certainly near the end of their time. They were having to do a fair bit of breeding within their groups, which probably wasn't all that healthy genetically. They may have had a larger number of what we could call, you know, bad mutations, if you like, which were building up because of these small groups and this relative inbreeding that they were exposed to. So I think in that sense they were a threatened species near the end of their time. But on the other hand, earlier on they clearly had diverse populations, as we did in Africa. So I think that the Neanderthals probably were subjected to much more severe climate extremes in Europe and Asia than our ancestors were suffering in Africa.
Does it come down to that in some ways? At least one factor of this, the idea that it just so happens Homo sapiens got lucky by being in a warmer climate.
Well, I think luck does come into it. I think that if you get a 5-degree temperature drop suddenly, which certainly happened with the regular ice ages and some of the very rapid fluctuations that happened during the last couple of 100,000 years, a 5-degree drop in Europe or Asia, in Northern Europe and Northern Asia, is going to kill you off, and it'll kill off the things you're eating as well. So I think the Neanderthals could never build their numbers long term, because they were continually kind of restricted to the better areas where they shrank back to in the bad times. Then they tried to bounce back when things improved, but then those groups would be cut off again by another rapid climate change. So their numbers, they could never build their diversity. In Africa, a 5-degree drop is, it can be bad news, but it's more likely to be changes in Africa of precipitation, of changes from rainforest at one extreme to grasslands and deserts at the other extreme. So in a big place like Africa, straddling the tropics, our ancestors were able to build larger numbers and larger genetic diversity. And that's something which comes through to the present day, that the present day African populations have as much genetic diversity as the rest of the world put together. So that diversity, I think, has been there long term in the human line, and we benefited from it, and it obviously gave us the survival value in the tropics, which the Neanderthals had trouble matching. And also, as I explain in the book, these larger groups are also important in terms of not only keeping inventions, but building up innovation. So when you have larger groups, first of all, you've got more chance of innovations arising. But also, if you've got larger groups who are networking and have a denser population level, you're more likely to keep an innovation alive and build on it than if you're in small groups where, there may be a genius who will think of some wonderful idea. But if that group, if that guy dies from an accident, or if that group disappears, that good idea will die with them. So I think modern humans also had an advantage of larger, more networked populations, which allowed them to also build up innovation in a way the Neanderthals had trouble matching, simply because of the environments in which they were living.
So in the sense that social sort of cultural information was passed on, in the sense that, for example, here's a way to keep a fire going, here's a way to preserve meat, this is what we did when we encountered this berry that was causing everyone to be sick. I mean, just passing on information, talking, learning amongst yourselves, that was a critical part of human survival, I suppose.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it can be summarized really by, it's not what you know, it's who you know, almost, in terms of keeping and building on knowledge. And that's something, so this is something that ratches up through time with modern humans. And the Neanderthals were certainly capable. They were intelligent. Their tool-making abilities were great. They knew the animals. They were having to hunt. They knew the plants that they needed to collect. So they, you know, they survived in quite difficult conditions for hundreds of thousands of years. So they were a successful species. Mm-hmm. I regard them as a different species, and that's probably another issue we should come on to.
Right.
But you know, from my point of view, they were highly successful. And I think in the end, yes, those climate changes, those very rapid ones, hit them and hit modern humans too. But I think because the Neanderthals were lower in number and lower in diversity, they had trouble hanging on. And ultimately, by maybe 35 to 40,000 years ago, physically, they had become extinct.
Yeah. It's interesting when you look at the number of different human groups, the Neanderthals among them, of course. It seems like you've talked about how they all started to disappear, the others that didn't survive, they all started to disappear right around the time modern humans began to spread. And there's the sinister question that does come up, whether or not the modern human, you know, whether we interacted and how we interacted with Neanderthals, whether we bred with them, but also whether we fought with them. And I'm wondering, is there any suggestion to say that there was violence involved in this story?
Well, it has been suggested, and given what we know about human nature, of course, it's quite possible that there was certainly violence within Neanderthal groups and within modern human groups, let alone between them. So in terms of the overlap of these groups, yes, there would have been an overlap of thousands of years, certainly, in certain areas where these groups did overlap. And I think that, you know, we just don't know enough about the encounters between the groups, whether they were mostly hostile or friendly. I think that, you know, there are very different views between the different experts on this. So at one extreme, yes, some people have proposed that we actually conducted warfare on the Neanderthals, even suggestions that we may have cannibalized them and basically really played a very active role in their extinction. There are a couple of examples of injuries of Neanderthals which people have proposed might have been caused by contemporary modern humans. But from my point of view, I don't see that evidence. I think you can't establish modern humans were in the vicinity at the time. And certainly if these were results of interpersonal violence, I should think it's much more likely it was caused by another Neanderthal than by a modern human. So it has been proposed at one extreme. Another view is that we basically displaced the Neanderthals in economic competition. So modern humans and Neanderthals would, you know, they'd both be wanting to hunt the same kinds of animals, to collect the same plant resources, to live in the best areas and the best caves and so on. So there would have been a competition between them. And the idea would be that if modern humans were just that little bit better in terms of their numbers and their culture, they would have displaced the Neanderthals to the less good areas, to the margins, up into the hills and so on. Now, that's fine when conditions are good, but when conditions turn bad, you've got nowhere to go if you're in those kind of isolated positions. So, I mean, that could have happened at times and in places, but overall, I think that it was a combination of factors, and for too long we, and that includes me, have been trying to find a single factor that will explain why the Neanderthals disappeared. But they ranged all the way from Gibraltar to Britain to Israel to Siberia. Wow. And I think it's unlikely that there's going to be a single factor that will explain their disappearance everywhere. And you could argue, well, it's the appearance of modern humans, but modern humans came out of Africa, it looks like, at least 60,000 years ago, and in fact they were out of Africa even earlier than that, in at least Israel. So 60,000 years ago, modern humans came out of Africa, and then there's at least 20,000 years when modern humans are around in Eurasia and the Neanderthals are around too. So that's quite a long time. They didn't just sort of give up as soon as they met modern humans. There was a long period of potential coexistence. And of course, yeah, at times, they may have been hostile encounters. At times, they may just have avoided each other. At times, indeed, they may have met and had cultural exchanges. And, of course, we know they had genetic exchanges. Yeah. So there was some interbreeding. And that's why most of us in the world today have a level of Neanderthal. Well, people outside Africa have around 2% Neanderthal right. DNA in them. And recent evidence suggests that even populations in Africa have a larger quantity of Neanderthal DNA than we used to think. So Neanderthals live on a little bit in us today. They are not, if you like, completely extinct.
Chris Stringer is with us. He's a paleoanthropologist, a researcher at the Natural History Museum in London. He's joining us from a studio there. His book, Lone Survivors, is in paperback now. The Lone Survivors, How We Came to Be the Only Humans on Earth. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The recent discovery of a new human species in a cave system in South Africa has gotten us thinking about the origins of humans. We're here with Chris Stringer. He is a researcher at the Natural History Museum in London, a fellow of the Royal Society. He's written a number of books and papers on this subject. He's been studying this, of course, all his life. We've been talking about his book, which is now out in paperback, called Lone Survivors, How We Came to Be the Only Humans on Earth. He's joining us from a studio in London. So let's get to the question of where it is we came from, that is this modern version of human that survived. You used to believe, you've said, that there was kind of a single spot, almost kind of like a Garden of Eden where we evolved and we changed and physically we changed, and then we became sort of the modern version of humans. But of course, you've changed your thinking on that. Now you say it's a little bit more complicated. So what can you say about where we came from?
Well, yes. As I just mentioned, there's even a bit of Neanderthal in us. So that they in a sense are partly our ancestors, but most of our ancestry comes from Africa, yeah. Genetically, physically, behaviourally. That's my view, and it's been my view for a long time. And I think that the fossil evidence certainly backs that, because if we look at the fossils that were around 500,000 years ago, in my view, there was a species called Homo heidelbergensis, named after a jawbone found near Heidelberg in Germany in 1907. And in my view, that species was a widespread species. It was in Europe, it was in Asia, it was in Africa. And in Europe and Asia, it started to evolve after 500,000 years ago towards the Neanderthals. In Africa, it started to evolve towards us. And I used to believe that our origins probably could be traced, that transition to Homo sapiens would be traced to one area of Africa, one special area, call it a Garden of Eden, of course, if you want, maybe East Africa, maybe Southern Africa. So I used to think that there was probably a rather punctuational origin of our modern features. Mm. So our modern, the fact that we've got a high and rounded skull, we've got a chin on our lower jaw, we've got a relatively lightly built skeleton. So I used to think that those features appeared really quite suddenly, that there was some perhaps major environmental change, maybe a modern human ancestral group got trapped somewhere and developed this modern anatomy in response to environmental pressures, and this also drove a very rapid evolution of the modern behaviour that we share today, this complex cultural behaviour. And the evidence now, I think, certainly shows that that isn't what happened, that, yes, we can find fossils in Africa which are 150 to 200,000 years old, and some of them look fundamentally modern. They do look like us in their skeletons, but there are other ones around at the same time that don't look like us so much. And culturally and behaviourally, we would look in vain at 150 or 200,000 years ago for cave paintings or little statuettes, the kind of thing we find much later on. So morphologically, these people were becoming more like us, but behaviourally, they still were different from us and quite similar to the Neanderthals in many ways in their behaviour. And that lineage is going to trace back even further to that common ancestor we shared with the Neanderthals maybe 500,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. So there'll be a long time in Africa when the modern humans were beginning, but we wouldn't if we saw them physically, they did not have all the features, of course, that modern humans have today. Well, that's evolution, because you wouldn't expect them to. But so I think I've moved away from that punctuational idea, and I've also moved away from the idea that there was a single centre of origin, because I think when we look at the fossils in, let's say, Morocco, Ethiopia, Kenya, down in South Africa, we can see fossils with, if you like, different combinations of modern human and what we can call ancestral characters. So there isn't just a single pathway leading to us today. I think that what we call modern humans kind of coalesced from different populations in Africa who, when the environments were right, were actually expanding their numbers, contacting each other, exchanging genes, exchanging ideas, and that drove the evolution of modern humans by about 100,000 years ago into what we, you know, recognisably can call modern humans. But it was a piecemeal process. It wasn't a single pathway, if you like, leading seamlessly through to modern humans. It was a more complex story in Africa than I used to believe.
And of course, that I think one of the biggest questions is, and you address this in your work, is have we stopped evolving? Let's just talk about just how many genetic changes, for example, have happened over the last few thousand years in the human genome, because I think this is important. I mean, how our genes, for example, responded to the emergence of agriculture and then to urbanization, because that's been altering who we are as humans, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's something which, again, we've only learned relatively recently. So I think there were many people, and probably including me, that thought that, well, by 35,000 years ago, you know, basically modern humans had evolved, and the changes afterwards were just tinkering around with the details. But we now know, as you say, that, you know, the environments in which we live in the last 10,000 years, and this includes, you know, the development of agriculture, putting people together in much larger numbers in urban centres. This itself has driven much of the evolution of humans, particularly the genetic evolution. So there are many thousands of changes in our genes that have come in the last few thousand years from these changes in the way we live. And, you know, it's only really having a wealth of genetic data that begin to show that. And have we stopped evolving? This is a big issue. And, yeah. And one of my colleagues in London, Steve Jones, the geneticist, I mean, he's argued a number of times that basically we've stopped evolving now. So basically, whereas in the old days, you know, if you had, let's say, an impacted wisdom tooth, you would die with that. No one's going to treat it. You'll get infected. You'll die. Today, of course, a dentist can take out that infected wisdom tooth and you'll survive. So he argues that medical care really has removed selection from human beings, and we basically have stopped evolving. And I think that's wrong. And I, you know, we publicly disagreed in a friendly way, right, because, of course, that's all very well when you've got the very best medical care, but there's still probably billions of people in the world don't have the best medical care. They don't have enough food and water. They are still subject to virulent infectious diseases. And selection is working on those billions of people pretty much as it ever did. So that's one thing. And secondly, of course, even in our own societies, there are some people who have lots of kids and some people who have no kids. So that's differential reproductive survival, and that is going to lead to evolutionary changes as well. Some people having a lot of kids, some people having no kids. So that will affect the gene pool. And, of course, under the surface, you know, each of us has mutations compared with our parents, maybe 50 mutations compared with our parents. So under the surface, each generation, there are new mutations which will carry on. So evolution is certainly going on. What we can't do is really predict, because evolution, of course, is it's not, you know, got a direction.
Right.
It's what works at the time and gets you through and allows you to reproduce and pass on your genes. It doesn't have a direction of its own, so we can't look ahead. And you know, you see these reconstructions of tiny bodied people with huge brains.
Right.
One of the things we can pretty confidently say is that that's certainly not going to happen, because, as I mentioned already, you know, the Neanderthals had bigger brains than us today. So did our ancestors have bigger brains than us today. So modern humans in pretty well every part of the world have got brain sizes and skull sizes 5 to 10% smaller than people did 10 or 20,000 years ago. So that's kind of pretty scary, really. You know, we think we're getting, you know, more and more sophisticated, more and more intelligent, and yet our brains are actually slightly smaller than the brains of the modern people who did the cave paintings of Europe and the Neanderthals too.
You know, there are a number of these different versions in novels and movies. I'm thinking there's a Pixar film called WALL-E, and it imagines human beings as these kind of obese creatures because of innovation. And so you can't imagine a sort of a physical manifestation that will change us in a reaction to the modern lifestyle that will make us – well, I guess you can imagine us fatter, but I'm just trying to imagine how that would change, you know, the size of our – femurs or the length of our fingers, you know, all those kind of particular things.
Well, of course, it does change it because when we look at the skeletons of people who were hunter-gatherers, you know, their lives were very demanding.
Yeah.
Their skeletons, I mean, bone is a living tissue, so it responds to the stresses and strains put upon it. So if you are very active, your bones will, you know, develop to cope with that level of activity, with the muscles working on them and the strains you put on the bones, the amount you walk and run. Clearly, if you are leading a sedentary existence, your skeleton is never going to build up that strength. That's fine, of course, if you don't ever need the strength, but if you suddenly do need that strength, it's not going to be there, you know, unless you really take regular exercise and at least try and approximate the kind of level of exercise which our ancestors had. But they were, you know, when you look at, we've got a leg bone from Boxgrove in Sussex, half a million years old. So this is a leg bone probably of Homo heidelbergensis. It's massive and extremely thick compared with a modern human tibia, a shin bone. And that's because that person, probably a man, that person, you know, had an extremely demanding lifestyle and their skeletons were built for that lifestyle. So with the exception, we're kind of wimps in our skeletons now compared with our ancestors.
What do you know about there's this question, it comes up from time to time, about paleo diets and barefoot running is interesting. I'm wondering, what do we know about when early humans started putting things on their feet, stopped running around barefooted?
Well, it looks like that was a pretty recent thing. So Eric Trinkaus, a colleague of mine, American anthropologist, you know, he's looked at the foot and looking at the proportions of the bones in the feet, you can actually make a pretty good judgment whether people were shod or not from slight changes in their foot bones.
Wow.
And when you look back in the past, you can see that the Neanderthals don't look like they were wearing shoes. But by the time you get to the modern humans of 35,000 years ago in Europe and Asia, it looks like they were wearing shoes by that time. So that had come in, but it looks like a fairly recent innovation. And before that, undoubtedly, as I say, people were highly active and they were mostly, as far as we know, running around barefooted. And their feet were obviously built to withstand that. And it looks like running and jogging and long distance walking were very important in the success of early humans before modern humans. Our more distant ancestors were clearly covering long distances, and bipedal walking, it's certainly not very fast, but it is, you know, pretty efficient. A lot of us without too much training can actually run marathons, and that's something which many other mammals would frankly find difficult, if not impossible, with their body build. So yes, a horse can outrun us, of course, very, very easily. So can many mammals, but over a 26-mile distance, most of those animals would struggle to cover that distance efficiently, and many of them would probably be dead from overheating if they tried. So we have got some special physiological adaptations that look like they do allow us to cover long distances very efficiently by walking, jogging, or running.
Chris Stringer is with us, researcher at the Natural History Museum in London, a fellow of the Royal Society. He has a number of books and papers. We've been talking about his book, which is now out in paperback, called Lone Survivors, How We Came to Be the Only Humans on Earth. We need to take another quick break, and we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Chris Stringer. We're talking about how we came to be the only humans on Earth. It's the subtitle of his book, Lone Survivors. He's joining us from a studio in London, researcher at the Natural History Museum in London. Let's talk about the stunning discovery revealed last month of this new species, the Homo naledi, discovered not far from Johannesburg, South Africa. There's still a lot of questions you've said about all of this, but what do you make of the collection, though, of bones? I mean, it seems pretty extensive. 1,500 bones or something? 15 individuals, maybe?
Yes, it's a phenomenal collection, just from one site, from one small chamber. So this is the biggest single collection of human fossils from anywhere in Africa. It's matched in terms of a single site only by one site in Europe, Atapuerca, which has over 6,000 human fossils from a cave chamber dating from about 400,000 years old. So this Naledi sample at the moment is about 1,500 fossils representing 15 individuals. But all of this is coming, I think, from only about a square metre of the cave sediment. So there's an awful lot more to come from this Rising Star cave system. There will be many thousands more fossils to come. But many questions, yes. It's been named a new species, Homo Naledi.
Do you agree with that, by the way?
I think it is a distinct species, yes, but there is dispute about that. But the material is undated, and I think that the team, you know, the material was found a couple of years ago. I think the team probably could have done a bit more to date the material than they have done so far. I'm sure they're working on it behind the scenes to date the material. And also, of course, there's a big question mark over how this material came to be deep within the cave system. It's in a dark zone well away from the existing cave entrance, something like 80 meters away. And the team, their best conclusion really was that other members of the population were actually depositing their dead in this cave chamber. And of course, that's something which humans today do, and the Neanderthals certainly were doing. But this is a creature with a brain the size of a gorilla's brain, much, much smaller than what we'd normally think of as a human brain. So would it be engaging in that behavior? And how did it get deep into the cave, into darkness? Would they have had to have had fire and torches and light to get down into this deep system? So there are some people who think that perhaps there was a nearer entrance which is blocked at the present day, and maybe that was how the material was moving in. There are suggestions already that there is another chamber in the cave which has quite a lot of bone in it as well, perhaps of the same species. So I think once that is studied as well and we can compare the two chambers, then we will have a better idea how that material got there.
You say that if the Homo naledi bones, if they turn out to be more than 2 million years old, that they could be fairly close to the origin of our own genus. But what if they're less than that, insignificantly less than that? What if, for example, they're less than 100,000 years old? What does that tell us about them?
Well, yes, in terms of their morphology, they do clearly show a primitive anatomy. I mentioned the brain size already. Other aspects of the upper body, for example, are quite distinct from the normal human anatomy, so quite primitive. So however old they are, they retain a lot of these primitive features. But yes, if they were less than 100,000 years old, that would, of course, be very surprising. But we have an example over in Flores in Indonesia.
Right.
There's an island there which has this creature been nicknamed the Hobbit, a tiny statured, apparently human species, Homo floresiensis, that was living there within the last 100,000 years and has a brain size even smaller than Homo naledi. And the mainstream view is that this was a long-term isolated population of humans that had been on that island perhaps for a million or more years, evolving in splendid isolation, if you like, retaining and perhaps even developing some of these unusual features along the way until possibly within the time range of modern humans. And so modern humans might even encountered these creatures when they got to Southeast Asia. So that's one of these other human groups that were probably around as modern humans dispersed from Africa. And we may have met them. And, well, as I mentioned, the interbreeding with Neanderthals, who knows what happened if and when modern humans met Homo floresiensis.
So broadly, what the Homo naledi discovery tells us is just that our genus is, I guess it confirms what you've been concluding lately, and that is that we have had some pretty complex origins, I guess.
Yes, that's right. I think that, you know, we've got these different human groups, and it isn't a linear progression. There are radiations of these human-like forms, and they continue alongside each other. We can see at times that some groups are more successful than others. Ultimately, all of these other groups died out except for us. So we are indeed the lone survivor. So this is an exceptional time in human evolution with only one kind of human around. But, of course, the genetic data shows that, if you like, modern humans did, to a small extent at least, mop up some of these other groups. So the fact we have 2% Neanderthal DNA or so, the fact that populations in Australia and New Guinea have maybe 4-5% of DNA of another group we haven't had time to talk about, known only at the moment from Siberia, a group called the Denisovans. Yeah. They also seem to have interbred with modern humans as we spread out. So these things I call species, they're not behaving like biological species. They're not reproductively isolated. They evolve separately for long periods of time and develop separate features, but when they overlap, a bit of interbreeding happens. And that's something which we know of from mammal and bird species. It takes sometimes millions of years for mammal and bird species to become reproductively isolated. Mm-hmm. So I think with these human groups, certainly within the last 500,000 years, they never developed separately enough to become reproductively isolated. So a bit of interbreeding happened, but in my view, it wasn't, you know, it was the exception rather than the rule, right, which is why we have a relatively small level of that interbreeding showing at the present day. But it was important. Some of those genes may actually have selective value in our bodies, and that's why they've been kept in our DNA.
One of the sections in your book deals with the dynamic of race, how particular racial features develop, or rather than race, maybe we could say regional features, is how you also put it. And I wanted to ask you about that. But let me read a question that comes from one of our listeners, Brad in Salt Lake City, who writes, "I teach anthropology at a local university. And I've taught my students that in order to understand our recent history of exaggerated ideas about racial differences, it can be helpful to remember that for most of our deep history, we were encountering people who were much more different from us than we are from each other today. So we might be cognitively wired to exaggerate the differences among ourselves." He says, "We imagine people from different parts of the world to be almost a different species, but that really was true for much of human history, and those differences were very significant." What do you make of that sort of comment by Brad, and put it in the context of how you understand race in the
story?
I
think he's got a good point in thinking of, I mean, I've kind of compared when modern humans met Neanderthals. I think you're talking about a difference there that is 2 or 3 times as great as the difference of when we might meet for the first time a human from another region. So when modern humans, when Europeans got to Australia, modern humans were there, the Aborigines. Those groups have been separate in evolutionary terms, you know, you could say maybe for, not completely separate, but for something like 40,000 years. When our ancestors came out of Africa and met the Neanderthals, they had effectively been separate for hundreds of thousands of years. So yes, I think he's got a point there. And of course, the way that we look at each other, we obviously look at people's faces when we first look. The face is a great signalling system for us. So you notice differences in skin colour, you notice differences in eye colour, you notice differences in hair. And yet the amount of DNA that produces those differences is really very small. So it's certainly true that modern humans, genetically, we have far more in common with each other globally than, you know, we have separating us in terms of the DNA. So I think that's absolutely a clear point. And in my view, these regional so-called racial features were add-ons to the shared modern human anatomy. So in my view, we developed the shared anatomy, and most of our behavior and most of our DNA that had evolved and developed by about 100,000 years ago in Africa. I'm not saying it's the end of the story. I've mentioned that genetic change has carried on. Right. But, you know, most of that was there 100,000 years ago. And then we emerged from Africa and took that to the rest of the world. And it was only at that point, I think, that these regional so-called racial differences evolved. So they were add-ons. Mm. They don't have a lot of DNA controlling them. And certainly some of them are in response to environments, different levels of sunlight, different temperatures where you have short wide bodies or tall slender bodies in relation to conserving or losing heat, and also sexual selection, which is something Charles Darwin advanced mm-hmm. as an idea. And I think that is indeed a part of the story too, that different groups have different standards of beauty and attractiveness, and that can drive some of these physical differences. So yes, we may, you know, at first glance look very different, but of course genetically we're not. And of course the human, you know, the smile reflex, for example, is universal in mm-hmm. humans, certainly as far as I know. But did the Neanderthals smile? You know, that's an interesting question. When we saw them, would we have seen those same human signals? Some people would say definitely. I would say that they were more distinct from any of us today than we are from each other today.
There was a reporter for National Geographic a few years ago asked you if you could go back and meet a Neanderthal, what would you ask him? And I really liked that question, so I'm going to borrow it. What was your answer if you could go back? Because you've described the Neanderthals as your favorite fossil peoples, so you clearly love them. How did you answer that question?
Yeah, well, I suppose if I could only ask a single question and we had a common language, yeah, that's a very good question, which I haven't really got a ready answer for you. But I'd certainly want to know whether that Neanderthal believed in a life after death, for example. You know, that would be an interesting question. So did they bury their dead for purely practical reasons to get the body out of the way of scavengers, or did they do it for a spiritual reason? And that would be an interesting question to ask a Neanderthal.
What do you think the answer is? I mean, do you think that they have a more complicated sort of spiritual worldview than Homo sapiens?
I think to begin with, it would have been a purely practical thing.
Yeah.
You don't want scavengers coming around your cave site, so you put the dead out of the way. And perhaps you're just extending care for people after they've died that you've looked after when they've been sick. But later on, I think the Neanderthals did start to invest it with more meaning. We do seem to find additions to the graves, even of Neanderthals. So they're adding something into that grave which may indicate that there is more meaning, perhaps even a spiritual meaning, to that burial.
Chris Stringer, paleoanthropologist, researched at the Natural History Museum in London. He is author of a number of papers and books. The book we've been talking about is Lone Survivors, How We Came to Be the Only Humans on Earth. Chris Stringer joined us from a studio in London. Chris Stringer, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And I should mention, if you're interested in learning more about human evolution, this weekend in Cedar City, the Smithsonian Institution is opening a traveling exhibit on human origins. That exhibit runs from October 16th to November 12th. It's at the Cedar City Public Library. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.